And welcome to another episode of A Language I Love Is, the podcast that's all about languages, linguistics, and love. I'm your host, Danny, and today's episode is a first for the show, a returning guest. After his superb introduction to Ossetian in Series 1, Dr. Samapriya Basu is back to share his passion for another language. This time, we're talking Kashmiri.
Persian, Farsi, Sanskrit shabdan huns istemal gatsan, Sanskrit bulan huns asar bosnevan.
Right, so this is a fantastic first for this show, because today we have our first returning guest. We have the first person to make a repeat appearance on A Language I Love Is. After his incredible tour de force all about Ossetian as part of Series 1, which was super, I highly recommend that people go and listen to that and dive into this fascinating Iranian language that's stuck in the Caucasus Mountains, I am delighted to welcome back to the show Samapriya Basu to talk about another one of the many languages that he has expertise in. Just to reintroduce him, Samapriya is a postdoctoral researcher at Simon Fraser University, which is in British Columbia in Canada. His bread and butter actually is statistics, but he has this incredible encyclopedic knowledge as well of Indo-European languages. So let's get started. Samapriya, thank you so much for joining me again. How are things with you? How's life in Canada?
It is good. I'm glad to be back. So really enjoyed last time. And also, I have been enjoying, you know, all the other episodes, fascinating languages that some of which I had not known about, you know, much before. So always glad to learn.
That's wonderful. That means a lot to me, the fact that linguists and non-linguists alike are listening and getting something from this. Because, well, even if you are the most incredible linguist within academia, you just can't know all the languages of the world. It's not possible. And as you mentioned last time, it was so interesting that from your perspective, as a linguist and as a speaker of many languages, European languages are quite exotic to you. They are sort of outside your linguistic comfort zone. And I highly recommend that people go and listen to what you had to say about your preferences and your interests as a linguist. It was, it was eye-opening for me. Today, you have a new language for us, a language that, again, I think there was a little bit of hesitation about what you were going to talk about, but you've pinned it down to a new language. Please tell us, what is another language that you love?
Okay, so another language that I love is Kashmiri.
Fantastic. Let's get started. So I'm going to go out on a limb and say that Kashmiri as a term is going to be quite familiar to people. I think people will have heard of Kashmir, not only the material, but also the region. But so that we're all on the same page, let's start with the geography of this language. Where can we find speakers of Kashmiri? And what is its relationship to the region of Kashmir?
Okay, so first of all, I think people use Kashmir in two related but not exactly identical senses. And I think it's good to disambiguate the two uses. So Kashmir in the narrow sense refers to the Kashmir Valley, where the majority of the 7 to 8 million speakers of Kashmiri are located. It is a mountain valley up in the Himalayas. So the Himalayan mountain chain runs roughly southeast to northwest. And so along the north, the Kashmir Valley is bounded by the main chain of the Himalayas, the highest mountains in the world. And in its south, it's bounded by the Pir Panjal Range. And so it's a little valley that's surrounded by mountains on all sides. It's a very beautiful valley. And it opens to the northwest and to the southeast. Those are the only two major openings into the Kashmir Valley. So in some ways, it is relatively isolated within the mountains. That, of course, does not mean that Kashmiri speakers do not have contact or have not had contact with anybody else. Those passes allow free movement all the time. So that's the narrow use of Kashmir. Now, most of the Kashmir Valley today is part of Indian administered territory. There's a little bit of the Kashmir Valley, which is in India, that part is called the Kishanganga Valley. In Pakistan, that part is called the Neelam Valley, which is in Pakistani controlled territory. So there are most Kashmiri speakers are in Indian territory, and a small portion of Kashmiri speakers are in Pakistani territory. And the broader sense in which Kashmir is used is for the entirety of the Jammu and Kashmir princely state, which was a princely state under the British Empire. So what princely states roughly meant was, I'm no expert in the administrative history of the British Empire, but I'll just give a brief introduction to it. It was basically, it was a territory that was not directly under the British crown, but administered via local rulers. There were about 500 to 600 different princely states. Most were really small city states like Hyderabad. Some were big, like the Khanate of Kalat, which is modern-day Balochistan, and Jammu and Kashmir. And Jammu and Kashmir includes, of course, the main Kashmir Valley, but it also includes a bunch of other places like Ladakh, which is the western end of the Tibetan Plateau. It includes Jammu, which is the Dogra-speaking areas. It includes the Chenab Valley, which is an extremely linguistically diverse area, and includes Gilgit-Baltistan up in the north, which is today part of Pakistan, where northern neighbors of Kashmiri, such as Shana, which is an Indo-Aryan language, Balti, which is a Tibetic language, and Burushaski, which is a language isolate, are spoken, among other smaller languages like Wahi, an Iranic language. So it is an extremely diverse region, Gilgit-Baltistan. In the other parts, like on Ladakh, it's mostly Tibetic languages, like Ladakhi, Zanskari, Chantang. And south of Kashmir, we find in Jammu and the Chenab Valley, several different Indo-Aryan languages like Dogri, Bhadravahi, Rambani, Pogali, Kishtavadi, many small languages that, you know, very few people have heard of outside of that region.
So we've established that the political geography of this region is quite complex. Speakers of Kashmiri in this part of the world find themselves on two sides of a serious border. This is not a border that is easy to cross. Does that mean that the language on both sides of that border has different fates, has different vitality, would you say? And also, has this any effect on the way that this language is written down, the fact that it finds itself in Pakistan and in India?
Yeah, that's a good question. So as I mentioned, on the Pakistani side, the number of Kashmiri speakers, there are more people who may identify as ethnic Kashmiris, but may not necessarily be speakers, like all the way in Punjab, for example, the former Bayayir, Prime Minister of Pakistan, Shahbaz Sharif, his ancestors like immigrated to Punjab from Kashmir at some point. So he identifies as, and probably identifies as, an ethnic Kashmiri, but then those people like don't necessarily speak Kashmiri as a language anymore. They speak like Punjabi or Urdu. So there are people who would identify as ethnic Kashmiris in other parts of Pakistan too, but actual Kashmiri speakers are kind of specifically located in the Neelam Valley or Kishanganga Valley. And even there, the language is sort of being replaced by Hindko, which is a Punjabic variety, a far Western Punjabi-like variety, whose speakers outnumber the Kashmiri speakers in that area. Sometimes in Pakistan, people are not really aware of like what Kashmiri is as a language, because it's just such a small portion of the population that speak it. So oftentimes you would find in Pakistan that people refer to other neighboring languages of south of Neelam Valley, like, for example, Mirpuri, as Kashmiri, but Mirpuri is a completely different language. Most Indo-Aryan speakers in Britain are Mirpuris, by the way. So it is a major language in Britain. but Kashmiri is not that many Kashmiri speakers. Now, on the Indian side, of course, Kashmiri is one of the recognized scheduled languages of India. So it has like some official standing. And as I said, most of the speakers are in India. What script the language is written in is a little complicated question. And it has to do with, you know, the majority of Kashmiri speakers are Muslims. And there's a very small Hindu minority. Most of the Hindu minority, till the early 1990s, they used to live in the Valley of Kashmir. But unfortunately, there was an ethnic cleansing of the Hindu population of Kashmir. So now they're mostly spread in other parts of India, like mostly in the big cities of India. It had to do with the entirety of the Kashmir conflict. So most Hindu Kashmiri speakers you find in like Jammu and Delhi and Mumbai and many of the other bigger cities, but Muslim Kashmiris are still concentrated, and who are the majority, by the way, in the Kashmir Valley. Unfortunately, because of the conflict, it is a heavily militarized area, you know, on both sides of the border, and all of the complications that come with border disputes. So yeah, coming back to like how the language is written, Kashmiri, for most of its history, has been an unwritten language. That is, it's mostly been an oral language, and that's not because the speakers were necessarily illiterate. Actually, Kashmir has had a really like high culture of literacy for much of its history. But back in the Hindu period, and also like by Hindus in the Muslim period, a lot of the literature composed was in Sanskrit. You know, many of the famous Sanskrit authors like Kalharna, Bilharna were Kashmiris. So Kalharna is often called the first Indian historian. And others, like, for example, Kalidasa, who's more famous, we don't exactly know where he's from, but some people have hypothesized that he may have been a Kashmiri. But all of these people, you know, they wrote in Sanskrit, not in Kashmiri. We have very limited attestation of medieval Kashmiri. There's like this one philosophical Shaivite text called the Mahayana Prakasha, which is in like medieval Kashmiri. Another mythological text, like a Puranic story of called the Bana Surakatha by Avatarabhatta, which is in Kashmiri. Those are all date to the 12th to 14th centuries or so. That's all the medieval record we have. There's another famous Shaivite poetess, Lalgid, who lived in the, I think the 12th century or something like that, whose poems are still sung today. But the language of those poems is not exactly what it used, what Lala would have composed it in. Like she would have composed it in her native medieval Kashmiri, but because it's been orally passed down generation after generation, and not in a Vedic sense of like maintaining pronunciation, but like simply sung by common people. So that kind of makes those poems actually change along with the language. So the language there is pretty much modern Kashmiri, and it's still, and those poems are still sung today by Kashmiri Hindus, and to a lesser extent, some of the more secularized poems by Kashmiri Muslims. For much of its history, the language was not written. Whatever record we have of writing from the early periods is in the Sharada script, which is a Nagari script. So it is related to like, you know, Devanagari and the Bengali script and the Gurmukhi script of Punjabi. So it is, Sharada is related to those. Today, unfortunately, Sharada is has mostly gone out of use. There is one group or one or two groups working to revive it for Kashmiri, but it's, you know, not been too successful. Kashmiri Muslims typically write their language in the Perso-Arabic script. There is some amount of literature in the Perso-Arabic script in Kashmiri. Kashmiri Wikipedia is written in that script, by the way. But again, it's only recently that the writing system, the orthography, is being standardized, unlike, say, languages like Hindi or Bengali, which have had literary traditions for much longer. So this means that, you know, when people write down, some of it can be quite hard to read because they're not necessarily, you know, sticking to one particular orthographic scheme. In addition, Hindu Kashmiris in other parts of India, mainly because they're now educated, you know, in English and Hindi for the most part, because they don't live in Kashmir anymore. A lot of them are using the Devanagari script to write Kashmiri. But even then, you know, not a lot of people are using it. And texting, for example, people would just use ad hoc romanization, which is like completely arbitrary. But today, the official script is Perso-Arabic in its semi-standardized form. A lot of people are trying to make the Devanagari script that some Hindus use also like co-official. And there is an attempt to revive the old Sharada script as well for Kashmiri, but with limited success.
You mentioned the fact that they are using the Perso-Arabic script, that is to say, the Arabic script as it was used and transmitted and modified in the Persian tradition. I'm just assuming that Kashmiri, like so many Indo-Aryan languages, has been influenced by Persian. You said that our kind of historical record for Kashmiri is obscured because people were writing other languages, and at an earlier point in time, that would have been Sanskrit. But I presume in the medieval and early modern period, that would have been Persian. And has Persian had an influence on this language?
Yes. So I think Kashmir came under like proper long Islamic rule sometime in the 15th century, mid 15th century or something. And subsequently after that, most of the population were converted. And from that time, I don't think there's a lot of record of Kashmiri writing, you know, in the medieval period. But in the early modern period, we do have like poems and things written by Kashmiri people. And as you said, Persian was the official language for a long time. And Kashmiris of both religions learned Persian. There are I have lots of Kashmiri friends who say like their grandparents knew Persian and actually wrote in Persian or wrote in the Persian script. So the influence of Persian on Kashmiri, there is lexical influence of Persian. And in the poetic tradition, sometimes you find calques of Persian constructions. For example, the Azafa construction, which is like really common in like poetry, even in like Hindi Urdu, not just in Kashmiri, you do find that. But people sometimes tend to, even in India, I've seen like people sometimes tend to overestimate the influence of Persian on Kashmiri. They sort of like imagine that because it is a language spoken by a majority Muslim population, it must be like, you know, completely Persianized or something, which is actually, it's surprisingly less Persianized than Hindi Urdu. there's you know, even a vocabulary, for example, Hindi Urdu and most languages of Plains India use the Persian word hazar for thousand, right? Kashmiri actually retains the native Indo-Aryan word. It uses sas for thousand, not hazar, which is the Persian word. Sas comes from Sanskrit sahasra, which is thousand in Sanskrit. And Kashmiri uses that still. That's how people count. There is Persian influence, but and quite a lot of it, but it's also very easy to overplay that Persian influence on Kashmiri.
Interesting. Yeah, all these different factors at play. For the sake of clarity, I would very much like to put Kashmiri in its genealogical context. You've mentioned so many languages so far and how they have some sort of connection to Kashmiri. We should be clear, this is an Indo-Aryan language, so it belongs to this large group of languages that you find in modern-day India, in modern-day Nepal and Bangladesh, and in Pakistan, of course. What that means is that it is also an Indo-European language. We should be clear about this. It belongs to this huge family of languages, the Indo-European languages, stretching in Eurasia from India to Ireland. Is that ancestry obvious at all with Kashmiri? If a native English speaker, such as me, were to look at Kashmiri, would I be able to kind of spot some Indo-European roots among all the words?
You can. And it's actually interesting. I love bringing up Kashmiri for this reason, because it shows that the rate of change of language is not necessarily always, it's a good example, good exemplar of showing the rate of change of language is not always, you know, constant across history. As you said, Kashmiri is an Indo-Aryan language. So it is related to languages like Hindi Urdu, Bengali, Punjabi, Sindhi. It's also a fairly conservative Indo-Aryan language in the sense that, well, no Indo-Aryan language is truly conservative, no modern Indo-Aryan language, not like, you know, the Balto-Slavic languages. They all have undergone, you know, several phonetic changes and morphosyntactic changes. So once again, to bring this in context, Indo-Aryan is typically divided into three stages, roughly. So you have Old Indo-Aryan, which is, of course, Sanskrit and the language of the Vedas and a few subsequent texts. Then you have Middle Indo-Aryan, which roughly begins, I mean, all these cutoffs are always arbitrary, but we can sort of say that the early Middle Indo-Aryan period is roughly set to coincide with the time of the Buddha. So say around 500, 400 BC or so. And then our earliest record of Middle Indo-Aryan comes from the Ashokan inscriptions, which are mid 300 BC. And also in Sri Lanka, right about the same time, early Sinhalese, or sometimes they're called Sinhalese Prakrit, starts appearing just a few years after the Ashokan inscriptions, maybe 50 years after or so. Ashoka sent his own son and daughter to like preach Buddhism in Sri Lanka, and that's how writing reached Sri Lanka. So Sri Lanka, we got writing very, very early. And in the plains afterward, there's like, we start discovering minor inscriptions here and there in like the local dialects. These are often called the Prakrits. And then there were also like, you know, Prakrits being used to compose plays. So we see several dialects of Prakrits represented in these plays. It's very hard to directly map on like one of those attested Prakrits to any modern language, because there seems to have been a lot of dialect mixing in those 1,000 years or so. But still, we kind of have that record. And when we look at those Prakrits and we compare that to Kashmiri, it seems like the direct ancestor of Kashmiri is not attested among those Prakrits. And it becomes quite clear that what would have been a Prakrit equivalent of Kashmiri was a fairly conservative language. in the sense that all of the attested Prakrits, for example, most of the attested Prakrits merge the three sibilant system of Sanskrit. So Sanskrit has three S-like sounds, sha, sha, sa, right? In the plains Prakrits, those all merge together as sa. But in the far mountains, we see languages like Kolar and Chana. Chana is just spoken north of Kashmiri, where the three are still preserved distinctly. So Chana speakers, even in the name of the language Chana, you have their sha, right? And so sha, sha, sa are distinguished. And it seems like medieval Kashmiri was much the same way. So till that time, it had changed very little from, you know, ancestral Sanskrit. But after that, unlike Chennai and unlike Kolar or Kalashra, Kashmiri accelerated a lot of changes. So, for example, it still retains the three-way sibilant contrast, but not as sibilants. So, sa remains as sa, sha has become ha, and sha has become sha. So the contrast does retain, but the values of the contrast has changed. You know, I like to contrast Kashmiri with Oriya. Oriya is an Eastern Indo-Aryan language, which accelerated quite a, what had lots of, you know, early changes from Sanskrit, such that it was like any other plains language, you know, having many different changes. But then in the middle period, like right after the Prakrit period, it kind of froze. So it is conservative from then on, as opposed to Kashmiri, which was conservative to then, and then innovated a lot from the medieval period to the modern period. So to round up that long-winded answer to your question, Kashmiri, because of, you know, many such recent changes, lots of vowel losses, lots of umlauting happening, like vowel changes basically, can look unrecognizable even to modern Indo-Aryan speakers at the beginning. Although you do encounter a few cognates to languages like English, which just serendipitously look similar. They're cognates, but they should not be looking similar, but they do. For example, one example I love bringing up is like the Kashmiri word for dog is hun, which is the same as the West Frisian word for dog, hun. And the reason is that indeed they're cognates, but of course, West Frisian hun is directly related to, like, you know, German hunt and English hound, right? And those all come from the Proto-Indo-European, like, John, right? And Kashmiri hun also comes from that. But the way they've changed is that in Germanic languages, of course, kya directly became ha, or kya became ka, which became ha. While in Kashmiri, kya in Sanskrit becomes sha, and then sha becomes ha after the medieval period. So it's only coincidentally that they both end up as ha, even though they've taken very different paths to get there. But at the end of it, you get the word hoon in both West Frisian and Kashmiri.
Super. Absolutely super. I love that. That is such a nice example of the kind of accidental resemblance between words that are part of the same family. And I love the fact that I think for the first time on this podcast, we've just had a spoken word of Proto-Indo-European. So thanks very much for that. Now, there is something as a final question for me as part of this language biography. There is something I'd love to talk about, which is actually the grammar, or specifically the word order of this language. Because I am very much a European linguist. I read books about the grammars of other languages in European languages, about European languages, and Kashmiri often makes an appearance in those books. And it appears alongside languages like German, Swedish, Dutch, and I would very much like to dig into why it joins these languages when it comes to its syntax. Let's talk a little bit about the phenomenon of verb second, because Kashmiri is a verb second language. And before people start hypothesizing about long lost German connections between, you know, let's say Scandinavia and the Kashmir Valley, we should probably say is this is going to be accidental. If it is accidental, that is also fascinating. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Please tell us, what does that mean to be a verb second language? And why is that so unusual that Kashmiri should have this status?
Yeah, so that's a really good point. And it's, you know, one of the reasons I got interested in Kashmiri as a language, because as a native speaker of, you know, another Indo-Aryan language, Kashmiri, of course, is familiar to me. You can, you know, just by looking at the language, you can obviously spot cognates and, you know, various parts of the grammar are very similar. But one thing that native Indo-Aryan speakers always notice is that Kashmiri is a, as you said, a verb second language. Now, to explain what that is, most Indo-European languages have relatively free word order, which is pragmatically determined. You have case marking and verbal agreement and all of that stuff. It doesn't really matter where the word order is, but a preference is to place the verb at the very end of a clause. Okay, so most languages are preferentially verb final, most Indo-Aryan languages, and indeed most languages of the Indian subcontinent, regardless of family. So it's true for Dravidian languages. It's also true for some of the isolates. It's true for the Sino-Tibetan languages on the Indian subcontinental side. They preferentially put their finite verbs at the end of a clause. Now, Kashmiri and its close sister, Kishtwari, which is a very closely related language, some people call them dialects. I prefer not to because Kishtwari speakers are like, we speak a different language. And, you know, I work with Kishtwari speakers and I love their language. So Kashmiri and Kishtwari stand out among Indo-Aryan languages and indeed Indian subcontinental languages and indeed most of Eurasia, other than, you know, the far northwest in Europe and the far southeast in like China and Southeast Asia, in that it does not put its finite verb at the end of a clause. Rather, it fixes it in the second position. For example, if you were to say like, I will go home, in Kashmiri, you will say, bu gatsa. Gotta. Okay. So b is I, gotta is will go, and gotta is home, right? But in, for example, the equivalent in Hindi would be main ghar jaunga or jaungi if you're a woman. So in Hindi, ja, the verb form, comes at the end of the clause. In Kashmiri, it comes in the second position. Now in Kashmiri, you can order every element around it. You could say under certain pragmatic conditions, like if you want to specifically stress that you are going home and not anywhere else, gutsa, bu. You could say that in Kashmiri, but you cannot remove the gutsa, the finite verb, will go, to any other position than the second position. And this, as you mentioned, Danny, is a feature that you find in, you know, several Germanic languages, like modern German has it, modern Icelandic has it, modern Dutch has it, right? So Kashmiri, in this sense, sort of resembles those languages in its like basic syntax. Of course, like when you dig into the rest of the syntax of this language, for example, like how noun phrases are structured and everything like that, it looks like other Indo-Aryan languages. It's like strictly head final language. But specifically in the case of the position of the finite verb in the clause, it is a verb second language, it and Kishtwari.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so to be clear, this is really something that, listeners, if you are learning a Germanic language with the exclusion of English, verb second is really something that you should get to grips with. It is such a powerful and useful rule. It really opened my eyes as the key to producing a good grammatical sentence in German. So in German, for example, we talked about the position of the verb. It has to be second, not the second word, but the second constituent, the second thing, and it's fixed as it is in Kashmiri. So in German, for example, you could say, ich lese das Buch, I read the book. You can also say, das Buch lese ich, but in both, the lese needs to be second. Absolutely fascinating. And to be clear, there is no connection between the Germanic languages and Kashmiri, right? Nobody claims that.
No serious person would claim that. What we see is that in Kashmiri and Kishtwari, of course, it's become obligatory. You cannot make a grammatical sentence which is not V2. Well, other than like some kinds of dependent clauses, for example, a relative clause. Actually, those are usually phrases, correlatives. They can have a verb at the end, so that's the one exception. And when you have questions in Kashmiri, questions actually, they put the question word in the pre-verbal position, and then the other constituent goes before it. So the WH word is always in the pre-verbal position. So that kind of makes it possible to have the verb in the third position in Kashmiri and like specifically questions. So there are one or two exceptions. But as you know, like in German, there is the famous exception that subordinate clauses are verb final, right? There are a few exceptions here and there in Kashmiri, but overall, it's like strict V2. But there are V2-like tendencies. So I know someone in India, like a linguist in India, who's working on, you know, some of the other mountain languages, and he has observed some V2-like tendencies in like a few other mountain languages, which their default word order is still verb final, but they in some constructions, and it's not fully clear which, they can put the verb in the second position. So it becomes much more, you know, English-like, I guess. It's still, you know, a topic that needs more research to explain like the precise diachronic pathway by which Kashmiri and Kishtwari ended up the way they are. so different than all their sister languages, both to the north and to the south. Unfortunately, because we have such a dearth of medieval Kashmiri texts, and most of the ones that do exist are in, you know, are poetic texts, right? So, and poets always take liberty with syntax. So unfortunately, we cannot directly trace this phenomenon in a historical record, at least clearly, but there's still, you know, some things to be gleaned out of it. And I know there's one linguist like Sartre Verbeke, who's a Belgian Indo-Aryanist, who had started working on this problem. So there's definitely things to explore there. And I think Kashmiri is a wonderful case because, unlike in Germanic, where, you know, basically all Germanic languages behave that way, and they are in relatively concentrated part of the world, Kashmiri behaves, why does it behave differently than its sister and its neighboring languages, whether they're Indo-Aryan or not? So I think, like, it's an important piece of the puzzle as to, like, how V2 develops diachronically.
Now, after all that superb information about the Kashmiri language and its wider linguistic, political, geographical context, I just have one question, which is, why Kashmiri? Because in our discussion leading up to this podcast, I think you were in you were in two minds about what language you wanted to speak today, and I was delighted by the fact that you chose Kashmiri, but I didn't expect it. So I'd love to know what place Kashmiri holds in your heart and in your life, and why you decided to talk about it with us today.
So there's a number of different reasons. So I mentioned last time that I grew up in India speaking an Indo-Aryan language, and I had exposure to, you know, several other Indo-Aryan languages, one of which was Kashmiri. Kashmiris in India, like, you know, because it's probably one of the few places in India where it really gets cold. So they're famous for making shawls and sweaters. The Kashmir wool, for example, is really famous internationally. And we used to have, you know, one person whom was my grandfather's acquaintance, who was a Kashmiri shawl seller. And he used to, like, you know, sell shawls and sweaters to our family all the time. In India, you typically would call people like that uncles, right? And so, unfortunately, like, you know, when I was still a kid, and one of the many fights or skirmishes in the valley, like, unfortunately, he was killed. And we don't know exactly by who. But so I've always wanted to know more about the Kashmiri language, because I had that initial spark, sort of like as a kid, I knew a little bit about the language. I didn't speak it or anything. And then fast forward several years later, this is the boring part. Like, I fell in love with someone who was a Kashmiri speaker. It didn't last, but I still wanted to learn her language. And that's kind of when I actually began learning the language properly. Of course, like, that didn't last, but my love for the language remained. And when I started exploring, learning Kashmiri, it was like one of the first Indo-Aryan languages, like other Indo-Aryan languages, that I had to, like, consciously started learning as an adult. I noticed that, you know, I kept reading the linguistic literature on this language and finding that it has all these interesting features, like, you know, multiple agreement, verb second, split ergativity, which interacts in very, very complex ways with the person marking system, which is, again, different than Hindi Urdu. And of course, like, it has limited medieval attestation, which has never been subjected to, like, linguistic analysis, even though it would be very interesting, given that it's a language that has all these unusual features. It has interesting features in its, you know, phonology and also historical phonology. I like to call Kashmiri a linguist's language because it has, you know, all of these things, like in syntax and phonology and diachrony, that, you know, whatever your linguistic interests are, it can occupy you for a lifetime.
So given that preface that you've just given us about how Kashmiri is a linguist's language, it is a language with so much to interest linguists, especially in relation to its wider context, the fact that its neighbor languages, its sister languages don't have these features. Amidst all of those fascinating phenomena, what is something about Kashmiri that you really like?
One feature about Kashmiri that I really like is a grammatical feature. And it's the Kashmiri agreement system and how it interacts with the Kashmiri case marking system. So as some people may know from, you know, Hindi Urdu, that many Indo-Aryan languages, many modern Indo-Aryan languages, it wasn't a feature of, like, medieval or, you know, old Indo-Aryan languages, is that many modern Indo-Aryan languages are split ergative. Now, what that means is that in the perfect tenses, so the past perfect, the present perfect, that is when an event has been completed, languages like Hindi Urdu and Kashmiri don't show a typical Indo-European nominative accusative agreement pattern. That is, your subject will be unmarked and your verb will agree with the subject, and then your object will be, you know, in the accusative case. That is the case in, with a little complication, modern Indo-Aryan languages don't really have an accusative case. But anyway, that basic formula works in the non-perfect tenses, for example, in the future tense or in the present continuous tense in most Indo-Aryan languages. But in the perfect tenses, instead, what happens is for transitive verbs, the agent, that is the thing that is doing the verb, is given a marker, a case marker, which is called the ergative marker. And the verb usually agrees with the object, not with that subject, which is marked with the ergative marker. Now, there are several complications to this. I'm like oversimplifying this. And of course, many of these languages differ within each other. Like the system in Kashmiri is not exactly the same as in Punjabi or in Gujarati or in Hindi. And so many Indo-Aryan languages, by the way, have lost this feature. For example, like in Bengali and Shina, it's been lost. So they don't have ergativity anymore. But several still do.
Ergativity, I should say, this is a phenomenon that may be familiar to people from languages such as Georgian or Basque. These are often called, for short, ergative languages because its system is applied across the board. Split ergativity is when it only applies in certain tenses, when the verb is in a certain tense or aspect.
In the case of Kashmiri, it also interacts like very complexly with its person marking system. Now, Kashmiri can mark anywhere between 1 to 3 arguments, pronominal arguments, on its verb. So again, for an Indo-Aryan and also for an Indo-European language, that is very unusual. It's something, you know, multiple persons being marked on the verb, you see in polysynthetic languages like Circassian or Mohawk, right? But you don't necessarily see it in an Indo-European language. Indo-European languages are plain vanilla, agree with the subject, that's it. Or in the case of Indo-Aryan languages, in the perfect tenses, agree with the object, that's it. But in Kashmiri, you can actually string together many of these agreement suffixes, as many as 3. So if you say something like, I sent her to him, or something like that, all of I, her, and him can be marked on the verb. Now, exactly what is marked depends on the specific cases those arguments are in, depends on like what the relationship between the cases are, like a first person subject or a second person subject or a third person object or a second person object. You know, it's a very complicated system, you know, that's something that, you know, I cannot even explain just off the top of my head. Native speakers do it flawlessly, but for me, I have to always like think about like, what does the grammar say? but it's an intensely fascinating language. And I think like a lot of theoretical developments from a syntactician's point of view, which I'm not, by the way, but you are, Danny, a lot of the development and the syntax of agreement and of ergativity has been made by study of Indo-Aryan languages, particularly Hindi-Urdu. And Hindi-Urdu remains the most studied of these languages, but also more recently, people have been looking at, you know, how the Hindi-Urdu system differs from the system, say, in Gujarati and Marathi, right? Some of the languages that haven't been looked at in this respect are the ones on the Pakistani side, so like Sindhi and West Punjabi, which I think like offer incredible wealth of information. I wish some syntactician would look at Sindhi and Western Punjabi. They're very interesting, but they're largely in study. And Kashmiri is part of that puzzle of understanding how complex agreement systems work.
And so, as you've already said, we don't have a lot of historical data for Kashmiri. That complicates matters because we don't have documents through time that would allow us to see this system developing. But nonetheless, we do have Sanskrit. It's not really the ancestor, but it's sort of like the great-great-great uncle of Kashmiri. And in Sanskrit, there is nothing like this. Sanskrit is very much like Latin and Greek, and this whole idea of split ergativity is something that seems to emerge very naturally, but from what you're saying, not uniformly. It's something that is present across the Indo-Aryan languages, but not in the same way. There's a great deal of diversity within the different ways in which they string their verbs and their nouns together. Is that right?
Yes, indeed. So in the case of Indo-Aryan, and I think quite generally in Indo-Iranian, so I didn't mention Iranian languages here, but they too develop split ergativity. It's been lost in Persian. We don't know if it ever existed in Ossetic or not, because Ossetic has been isolated from other Indo-Aryan languages, but it's still there in like many Kurdish varieties. we sort of see the development of like what you could say proto-ergative constructions developing already in like late Sanskrit and old Persian. So as you know, Sanskrit past tenses were built with the augment often, and then a specific form of like tense and agreement suffixes. And there are a few Indo-Iranian languages which retain that system. So like Balasha and Kolar in like northern Pakistan and Yavnobi in northern Tajikistan, they still retain the augment. In that sense, they're pretty conservative. But most of the other languages lost that, you know, augmented past tenses and started building participial past tenses. The subject was usually placed in the case of Indo-Aryan, it was usually instrumental, but there are examples of genitive subjects as well. In the case of Iranian, it's always a genitive subject. But the constructions would be something like, instead of saying like, I am doing this work, you were basically saying that by me or of me, this work is being done, something like this. Or I did this work. Instead of saying I did this work, you're saying by me or of me, this work was done. And then because this done is a participial form, it agreed with the work that was being done, not with the I or by me that was doing the work. So that's pretty much how ergativity develops in these languages. So this passive participial construction later on in like early modern Indo-Aryan period, so you could say roughly in the Middle Ages, this construction becomes the dominant construction to make past tenses all across the board in Indo-Iranic, except for those, you know, languages like Khoar and Kalashra, which seemingly never developed this participial construction. They still do it the Sanskrit way, which makes them the most conservative Indo-Aryan languages today.
The third and final question of the whole format of this show, it remains the same, which is simply, what is a parting point that you have for us today about Kashmiri? What is something that we should go into the world now knowing about the Kashmiri language?
All right. So I want to, conclude with a little historical note about Kashmiri, because that's, you know, one of the things that got me interested in the language in the first place. As we've, you know, mentioned several times by now, that there is not a whole lot of historical record of the language. But whatever historical record there is, we see from it that medieval Kashmiri looked very much like other Indo-Aryan languages. So, you know, cognates are not hard to find. Many of the changes, as we said, they happen after the medieval period. And one of the things that makes Kashmiri sort of like somewhat mystical among speakers of other Indo-Aryan languages is that they often cannot hear familiar words in it because of sound changes. So unless you're like accustomed to the language a bit, you won't hear it. So that creates like a sort of mystique about the language in, for example, India and Pakistan. People don't often recognize it as like a related language or familiar language. And I kind of had this experience when in the pandemic, I kind of joined a Kashmiri learning group. It was mostly intended for like heritage learners of Kashmiri who were from Kashmiri families, but unfortunately the language was not passed down to them. So they were learning it, they had exposure to it, but it also included, you know, other speakers of other Indian languages. And at the beginning, everyone was sort of struggling because they were struggling to find cognates. But toward the middle of it, when people actually figured out some of those sound changes that Kashmiri does, like, you know, quite naturally, not everyone was a linguist, right? The Indo-Aryan speakers made progress really quickly. On the other hand, there were a few speakers of Dravidian languages like Kannada and Tamil who couldn't make progress as fast. So it was like really fascinating to watch for me, like speakers of Hindi and Bengali just like picking up Kashmiri incredibly fast after that initial blockade. The reason I mention this is that Kashmiri, of course, undergoes like, you know, some changes. The sh becomes h. So for example, the word for learn in Hindi is seek. And then Kashmiri, it's hitch, but that ha is actually related to Hindi sa. It's just that, you know, people don't recognize it all that often. And related to this, so Kashmiri undergoes what's called umlauting in the historical period. So many Indo-Aryan languages have secondary extensions to their adjectives and some nouns, depending on the gender. So for example, in Hindi, if you want to say, you know, a blue book, let's say, a blue book, right? So book is a feminine noun, kitab, and blue is, the stem is ni, but it has to take an agreement marker, nili kitab, okay? Because kitab, book, is feminine. On the other hand, if you want to use some other masculine noun, you would say ni la, and whatever the masculine noun is. An a is the masculine ending, as opposed to e. In Kashmiri, those endings used to be there in the medieval period. You would say like nilo and nili. But those vowels have reduced now to the point that they don't exist anymore. But what they have left behind is that on previous vowels, umlauting effects, and on preceding consonants, some kind of consonant gradation. So for example, in Kashmiri, if you want to say the blue book, you would say nij kitab. And the j comes because lo is palatalized to j before the e. And so that's why you would say nij, not ni. And likewise, the masculine form will be nul instead of nila, because it used to be nilo, then the nilo, nilu, and then nilu caused the e vowel to be umlauted to u, and then the final vowel actually drops, and now it's become nul. So Kashmiri has this amazing system of like umlauting within it and consonant gradation within its grammatical system. And one example I want to end with is that it also affects loanwords from Sanskrit and, as we started this discussion with, from Persian and Arabic. So, you know, for Muslims, the most important festival is Eid. And in Kashmiri, the word for Eid is, of course, borrowed from Arabic, is Yid. But in the dative case, like if you want to put, for example, a postposition after Yid, you would say Yiz with consonant gradation. So by regular sound changes within Kashmiri, the changes to Z and for certain feminine nouns in the dative case. So for example, if you want to say like, I will go home for Eid, you would say B gatse, I will go, Yiz Pyat Gara. So Yiz Pyat, Eid for Gara to home. And you would say Eid Pyat, you would say Yiz Pyat. Likewise, if you're a Hindu, and for Hindus, the most important festival is Hierat. Hierat is Shivaratri, which is the worship of the god Shiva. You would say, Bugatse Hierats Pyat Gara. So Hierat become Hierats again because of the consonant gradation. It's not well recorded in any, you know, it's, you know, no one's written this down anywhere yet, but if you learn the language, you kind of see it, and it has like a fascinating historical phonology in addition to an even more fascinating historical syntax.
And in doing so, you then can connect it to other languages that you may know. For example, I imagine that in those lessons, people are doing this quite naturally in their heads and connecting it back to, well, say Hindi Urdu, for example. So often, if you take the language at face value, if you take, as you say, these shifting consonants at face value, how yid is becoming yiz, that would be confusing. I think if I first encountered that in a language lesson, I'd be pretty confused. But apply a little bit of historical linguistics, I hate to say it again, and suddenly the patterns emerge. Fantastic. This has been super. This has been such another fascinating dive into a whole new language. There are so many strings to your bow, and I'm so pleased that you came along today to join us and tell us all about Kashmiri. Just from me and on behalf of everyone listening, just thank you so much, Samapriya. That was wonderful.
Yeah, it was my pleasure. Thank you very much.
This episode's final fun fact is more of an observation about modern English that follows on from our discussion about Kashmiri. As we mentioned, a distinct feature of Kashmiri is its verb second word order, whereby the verb must be the second constituent of its clause. This Kashmiri shares with the Germanic languages, but Samapriya and I made sure to exclude English from that comparison. English cannot be classed as being a verb second language, since putting the verb in second position is not as obligatory as it is in, say, German. However, English used to be such a language. In our Old English texts, we find that the verb consistently occupies an early position in the clause that would sound weird or outright ungrammatical to speakers of English today. The story of English is therefore the story of losing the verb second constraint over time, but it hasn't been lost entirely. For example, why do we say things like, under a tree sat a man, or here comes a bus? In our fairy tales, why can we begin by saying, once upon a time there lived a king and queen? In our novels, writers quote speakers with the construction, something, 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 said he. In our questions, we say, what will the woman see? Not simply, what the woman will see. If we start a sentence with not only or no sooner, a modal or auxiliary verb must follow, as in, no sooner had they left, or not only do I like this. Not only I like this is, for me, just wrong. These are all legacies of verb second, moribund in English today, but a rule very much alive in Kashmiri. So, that's everything for the moment. Please consider giving the show a rating wherever you get your podcasts and recommend it to all your friends and family to share the linguistic love far and wide. My thanks go to my guest today, Samapriya, and also to you, dear listener, for listening. Keep well and keep loving language.